The headlines this hour. Iran warns the U.S. and the European partners of the nuclear accord, but the negotiation window will not be open forever. Yemen's army says it has targeted several sites deep inside Saudi Arabia in a large-scale military operation. Also in the headlines, China says the U.S. will fail to disrupt the Winter Olympics and warns that a diplomatic boycott will only result in a loss of moral authority. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. A note of warning from Iran's foreign minister to the United States and the three European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. The window of negotiation will not be open forever. In an article written for a Russian newspaper, Kommersant, Amir Abdullahian says the main goal of the Vienna talks should be to effectively implement the deal. He notes that Iran will not accept any demands that go beyond the accord. He notes that Iran is prepared to return to compliance with the deal in case all sanctions are removed in a verifiable manner. He's also questioned Washington's will to remove the sanctions, saying that Tehran has an effective toolkit to neutralize their effect on its economy. The seventh round of talks between Iran and the P4 plus one went into recess on Friday. They're expected to pick up where they left off in Vienna later this week. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the United States is seeking to rehabilitate the Daesh terror group in the region. Ali Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Syrian foreign minister in Tehran. He said the U.S. is furious over the defeat of the terror group and is seeking to destabilize West Asia region. The Iranian official warned over a plot designed by the U.S. and Israel to create a security crisis in Syria. Shamkhani said any aggression and occupation will end in a humiliating defeat. For his part, the Syrian top diplomat said the illegal U.S. presence violates Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He added that Washington is seeking to create terrorist cells to harm stability in his country. Israel carried out fresh air raids on Syria, targeting the port city of Latakia several times. Syrian defense systems have intercepted several missiles. No casualties have been reported in the incident. Our Damascus correspondent Mohammed Ali joined us earlier with more on the attack.
At about 1:45 a.m. local time here in Syria, explosions were heard in the governorate of Latakia. Later on, about 1:50 a.m., the Syrian state media confirmed that there has been an Israeli attack in which Israel attacked the vicinity of the port of Latakia. We still don't know if there were any casualties. Definitely, there are some, of course, material damages over there. The Syrian state media also said that Syria's air defenses were able to intercept most of the enemy missiles and shoot them down. However, it seems that some Israeli missiles did hit the vicinity of the port of Latakia, because some images were published by locals on the internet showing some smoke rising and coming out from the vicinity of the port of Latakia.
The Yemeni army releases the details of its latest military operation against Saudi Arabia, coming in response to the kingdom's escalating attacks and continued siege. The army spokesman says a large number of drones and ballistic missiles were launched at military sites and other key locations in the Saudi cities of Abha, Jizan, Asir, and the capital Riyadh. Yahya Sari says the army also targeted the Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah. He called military sites the legitimate targets of the Yemeni army, urging Saudi residents living near those areas to evacuate. Sari said the Yemeni army would respond to aggression with escalation. On Monday, Saudi Arabia bombed Sana'a, the latest in over 100 raids against Yemen in the past 5 days. Our correspondent Abdul Latif al-Washali, who joined us earlier from Sana'a, says Saudi Arabia's ongoing aggression against Yemen legitimizes the army's military operations.
These attacks would never happen if the Saudi regime did not attack the Yemeni people, did not escalate its aerial attacks against the Yemeni civilians, and did not launch a deadly war against Yemen in the first place. So the Saudi regime is the one who is making these attacks legitimate by attacking Yemen and violating the sovereignty of the country. The Yemeni army, by the way, did not only attack Saudi Arabia yesterday. Simultaneously, there were several attacks on other military sites in the Marib governorate and other regions inside Yemen. They attacked the military camps of the Saudi-led coalitions forces. The Yemeni army is only responding to the Saudi attacks against Yemeni civilians. You can't attack a country, you can't attack a nation, and expect that these people will not hit back at you and your facilities. The Yemeni army has only attacked the facilities used for military purposes, such as the airports and also the military sites inside the kingdom. The Yemeni army has earlier vowed the Saudi regime that if they did not stop escalating their attacks against the Yemeni civilians, the Yemeni army will absolutely respond to the attacks and launch a wider and larger operations. Today, the Yemeni army used 25 drones, and this is the largest number until the moment, and a large number also of missiles, and this proves that the growing missile capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Powerful bomb explosion has ripped through Iraq's key port city of Basra in the south. At least 4 civilians are dead and 20 others injured. Local police say that a motorcycle laden with explosives went off in the city center near a hospital and a popular market. The blast set fire to a number of vehicles. Videos posted online show a column of black smoke rising from the site of the explosion. There is no claim of responsibility, but officials are pointing the finger at Daesh. The terror group continues to carry out sporadic attacks in Iraq since its defeat in 2017. The U.S. diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing is drawing an angry response from China, with its foreign ministry warning that Washington will pay a price for its mistakes.
The actions of the United States seriously violate the principle of political neutrality in sports as established by the Olympic Charter and runs counter to the more united Olympic model. It stands on the opposite side of the majority of athletes and sports enthusiasts around the world.
The ministry says Washington's plot to disrupt the international event will fail and that Beijing is prepared to take countermeasures. It warned that the decision would lead to a loss of U.S. moral authority and credibility. The State Department has said the U.S. government officials will not be attending the Games because of alleged human rights violations. The decision, though, will not affect American athletes who will still compete in the Games. The standoff over the Olympics is adding to a long list of disputes between China and the U.S., including trade, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and the COVID origins. Rhetoric ratcheting up between the U.S. and Russia just hours ahead of a meeting between their leaders. Washington now says Moscow will have to prepare for a stronger U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe should it move to attack Ukraine. The senior White House official says Washington would give a positive response to Eastern European allies requesting additional U.S. troops and military hardware to counter any threat from Russia. He also says Russia will face severe economic consequences in case of invading Ukraine. The Kremlin says it is not expecting any significant breakthroughs in the upcoming talks between President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart, Joe Biden. The two leaders are set to hold a video call in the coming hours for conversation that will include several issues. The White House says it's concerned over the Russian military buildup near Ukraine, warning that massive sanctions are on the way.
It's not about threats. It's about conveying that the right path forward here is through diplomacy. In the meantime, on financial sanctions, we've consulted significantly with our allies and believe we have a path forward that would impose significant and severe harm on the Russian economy. You can call that a threat. You can call that a fact. You can call that preparation, whatever you want to call it. But that is something we've talked about publicly, and certainly the president would convey that as well.
Washington and Kiev accuse Moscow of preparing for a large-scale military offensive on Ukraine, but Moscow says that NATO is infringing upon Russia with an eastward expansion, that the country needs the military buildup to protect itself.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, an all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity in sight. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to these could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Indian Foreign Secretary has confirmed that Russia has begun delivering long-range S-400 ground-to-air missile system to New Delhi, despite U.S. sanctions threat. Harshvardhan Shringla said supplies of S-400 would continue. He made the announcement after the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi held talks with the visiting Russian President Vladimir Putin in New Delhi. The deal for the Russian missile system, worth more than $5 billion, was signed in 2018. But Washington has threatened sanctions against India over the agreements under the 2017 U.S. law. The legislation is aimed at deterring countries from buying Russian military hardware. India, which is a strategic U.S. ally, needs the Russia S-400 missile system to modernize its armed forces. EU employment ministers have agreed to take measures to protect wage levels in the bloc as workers and employers are facing growing uncertainty due to economic pressures. New data shows the gap between the rich and the poor in the EU is growing. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
According to a study just published by the European Trade Union Confederation, wage inequality has grown in a majority of EU countries, 14 out of the 27 member states to be precise. The report was released to coincide with a meeting of EU employment ministers. They've agreed on a wage directive designed to protect those on low incomes.
The message coming today on the 6th of December from Brussels is a very positive, encouraging message, especially to those who are still in work poverty.
Millions of people in the EU are working in precarious jobs. Most of them are young adults.
A job well done requires adequate and just pay. This concerns the fundamental respect of people in their work. One of our priorities under the Slovenian presidency was high-quality job creation.
Although the new directive was passed here in the Council, Hungary and Denmark voted against it, while Germany and Austria abstained. Analysts say it's clear there will never be an EU-wide minimum wage. Pay systems and economies vary greatly. For example, currently, the minimum wage in Bulgaria is €312 a month. In Luxembourg, it is €2,142. Employers are afraid to invest at present due to all of the unknowns surrounding COVID-19, high energy prices and political uncertainty in some EU nations.
Businesses want certainty. They can't have certainty, but they would like a bit of predictability for investment reasons in particular. And they don't have that at the moment because of these issues that you just mentioned. And they don't know what's around the corner.
Disaster is around the corner for the EU project, experts warn, if the bloc's leaders continue in their failure to deliver greater social justice. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Afghanistan is being hit by drought, economic and displacement crises deteriorating day by day. With the World Bank donors expected to meet soon, the Afghan people have pinned hope on them to take some practical steps to alleviate the financial problems of the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Bhagwan reports from Kabul.
The World Bank spokesman has announced that donors to the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund have agreed to decide about the transfer of funds to humanitarian aid agencies by December 10th. In the meantime, people in Afghanistan complaining about the ongoing crisis in their country call on the donors to let the flow of aid and unfreeze the blocked assets.
I expect the donors to stick to their promises. What are they waiting for? We have lots of problems, including poverty and unemployment. Everyone will starve if no aid is sent to Afghanistan.
The world countries have always said that they are after helping us. The situation is worsening as the winter is around the corner. We hope that the World Bank donors help us get out of this disaster by sending humanitarian aid.
Economical experts say that however the aid would be helpful, but the international community, in cooperation with the Taliban, must seek other stable approaches for Afghanistan's economy, rather than relying on temporary programs.
The Taliban should show flexibility against the international community's request to gain trust so that the aid could be handed over to the new government in Afghanistan. The transfer of the frozen assets can be very fruitful amid the current poverty that the Afghans are struggling with.
This comes as the UN bodies and aid agencies are calling for more urgent assistance as winter bites. World Food Program says that it needs $2.6 billion to ramp up life-saving support to reach 24 million people in 2022. The U.S. has frozen nearly $10 billion in assets of Afghanistan as it tries to keep the Taliban away from accessing the money. The U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have led to a wave of hunger and poverty in Afghanistan, pushing a large portion of the people to the brink of a catastrophe. Afghans now hope that donor countries agree to extend a helping hand. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of the academic elite in making scientific discoveries. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country.
یه نکته دیگری که در باب نخبگان وجود داره من قبلها هم یه وقتایی به این اشاره کردم این است که یکی از هدف‌های جامعه علمی کشور نه فقط نخبگان همه جوامع علمی البته در مورد نخبگان این بیشتر مورد نیاز هست این است که باید به مسائل کشور فکر کنن مسئله محور کار کنن.
Another point about the academic elite, which I have mentioned once before as well, is that one of the goals of the country's scientific community, not just the academic elite, but all the scientific community, should be to think about the issues troubling the country and work in a problem-orientated way. Of course, in the case of the academic elite, this is even more necessary. Being problem-orientated is important. The country has fundamental issues which must receive attention. These must be solved scientifically.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
دوستان ما چند تا از این مسائل رو مطرح کردن و براش راه حل ذکر کردن.
There is a solution for every problem. Right now, our friends have raised a few of these issues and suggested solutions. Of course, I said that judging these solutions requires reflection and deliberation, but it is possible to find a scientific solution to all the problems of the country. So one should confidently try to eliminate these problems. For example, one of our current issues is the issue of water in the country. This is one of the problems. One problem in the country is the shortage of water, and this will become a more important problem in the world in the very near future as well. Well, a scientific solution should be proposed.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
French President Emmanuel Macron wrapped up his two-day tour of the Persian Gulf after a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Saturday. During Macron's visit to Jeddah, he and the Saudi Crown Prince discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis hit Lebanon. Beirut has been suffering from an economic crisis exacerbated by a diplomatic dispute between Lebanon and some Arab Persian Gulf states, especially Saudi Arabia, which had blocked imports. The rift between Riyadh and Beirut was sparked when former Lebanese Information Minister George Kardahi criticized the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. Macron landed in Jeddah after visiting the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. His visit marked the first meeting of the Western leader with Mohammed bin Salman since the assassination of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed that a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. U.S. intelligence services revealed that the gruesome killing of Khashoggi was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, Macron's visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accuse the French president of trying to rehabilitate Bin Salman. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip, given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations, such as the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, threatening activists, imprisoning human rights defenders, slaughtering Yemeni civilians, and so forth. Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. However, in a stark contradiction to his assertion, the French president signed a multi-billion dollar military contract on a previous day with the UAE during his visit to the country as part of his tour.
The reality is that France will put money, will put business, will put profits before human rights, before freedom, and before democracy. And the French are very keen to expand their military relationship with Saudi Arabia, partly to increase the amount of revenue they receive from their annual weaponry sales to the kingdom, but also to compete with British military sales to the kingdom.
The UAE plays a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and millions more displaced, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. During the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf, Macron gave a visit to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies slammed the agreement, blaming the UAE for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US.
France is a leading friend and ally to the Saudis. And on top of that, Saudi Arabia is the leading exporter and financier of terrorism in the world. And so, given that France has a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, demonstrates that not only is France complicit in terrorism, as is Britain and France, but also Paris has no regard whatsoever for human rights, democracy, or freedom.
Another country that has provided support for the Saudi regime despite its violations of human rights in Yemen is the United States. Last month, the Pentagon announced that the State Department had approved the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale followed the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The fact that the U.S. and France are the largest weapons exporters to Saudi Arabia brings one to the conclusion that Washington and Paris are only after selling their military hardware despite the war crimes Riyadh is committing and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives and displacement of millions more during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region.
So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences.
In the case of Ukraine, I think the Russian government has a right to be concerned that Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, is being played as a puppet of U.S. financial interests, U.S. political interests.
Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbass region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Deep-seated racism and Islamophobia once again resurfaced in the United States following threats and insults against Muslim House Representative Ilhan Omar. Lauren Barber, a far-right Republican congresswoman, insulted Omar by suggesting that she was a terrorist to a crowd at her own state of Colorado. Barber described encountering Omar at the U.S. Capitol and being relieved that she does not have a backpack, an apparent reference to Omar possibly carrying a bomb. Barber further insulted Omar by describing her as a member of the Jihad Squad.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that this isn't new in the context of racism in America, and that America has been a racist country since its founding. I think it's important to always understand or do your analysis of this issue with that being the underlying premise.
Last week, Barber apologized to anyone in the Muslim community that she may have offended, but refused to directly refer to Omar. Following Barber's refusal to apologize, the Muslim Democrat congresswoman received a racist, death threat-laden voicemail left for her. In a news conference on Tuesday, Omar called on Republican leadership, who have so far declined to punish Barber over the comments, to stand up to anti-Muslim hate. Omar, who became the first Somali-American and naturalized citizen of African birth to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives when she was elected in the year 2018, said the voicemail came through shortly after Bobart posted another video on social media on Monday. "We cannot pretend this hate speech from leading politicians does not have real consequences," she said.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, his refusal to call out Congresswoman Lauren Boebert is an example of how morally bankrupt, how ethically vacuous individuals like this are, because they're always going to make the political calculation of how their constituents are going to respond to something like this, instead of being a leader in a situation like this.
The latest insults heaped against Ilhan Omar have once again revealed the toxic environment against Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many Muslims became the targets of anger and racism. Mosques were burned or destroyed, and death threats and harassment followed many Muslims in the weeks following the attacks. Hate crimes against Muslims rose over 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. But even as the country moved further from the attacks and the Muslim American population in the country grew, discrimination against this community has not waned.
And so where we are now in terms of the intra-party struggle that we're seeing, inter- and intra-party struggle, where you have Congresswoman Boebert calling Congresswoman Omar a terrorist, that now is a result of Trumpian politics.
Anti-Muslim sentiment continued in the 2016 election cycle, during which Islamophobic hate crimes surged again. It is widely believed that the rise in hate to the anti-Muslim rhetoric was linked to the political discourse espoused by the political establishment in the U.S., especially the Republican Party and the people who gathered around former U.S. President Donald Trump, who made Islam and Muslims targets of criticism throughout his presidential campaign and tenure.
It's going to continue to be incredibly divisive from a domestic perspective, and it is going to, I think, drive more and more and more white supremacist, white nationalist policy, whether it be domestic or whether it be foreign. And I also think from a domestic violence perspective, we are going to see more and more examples of individuals taking matters into their own hands, using their own firearms, and attacking fellow citizens.
During the first months of the Trump administration, it was reported that roughly 75% of Muslim American adults said that there's a lot of discrimination against Muslims in the U.S. Shortly into his time in office, Trump signed an executive order that barred immigrants from several Muslim-majority countries. Islam has been seen in the Western world in a negative light, which is fueling the wave of Islamophobic attacks on Muslims.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion, as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war, because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia, with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions, as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences. Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: قدر الرجل على قدر همته، وصدقه على قدر مروءته، وشجاعته على قدر أنفته، وعفته على قدر غيرته.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The worth of a man is according to his courage. His truthfulness is according to his balance of temper. His valor is according to his self-respect, and his chasteness is according to his sense of shame."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali, and how Imam Ali's persona is applicable to today's day and age. We find that Imam Ali himself adhered to certain manners, and he lived by certain principles and fundamentals. And it is these principles and fundamentals from his life that we learn so many things, and things which we can apply in our own lives. For example, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam has said and has lived by this idea that a scholar who does not know a matter, if asked a question, must not be ashamed of saying, "Allahu alam," Allah knows better. You know, dear friends, it's interesting, but you don't have to be a scholar to be able to apply this in your life. For example, if you're a religious scholar or you are a religious student, then of course this directly applies to these kind of individuals, those who call themselves Islamic scholars and those who call themselves the students of Islam, or talabe, as is known in Farsi. These individuals, when asked a question, and if they don't know, they shouldn't be ashamed to say that they don't know. They shouldn't be ashamed to say, "Well, Allah knows better." It's interesting, but if we were to apply this, let's just take it as an aspect of a religious scholar or a student of religion. Instead of making up answers for something that we do not know, and of course, making up an answer is just going to lead people astray, instead of making up an answer and coming up with something on the fly, as it is said, if we were to actually just say, "I don't know, but for example, I will make sure to search it up, and if I find the answer, I will provide it to you. Allah knows better." How many different kinds of misguidance and misinformation and misconceptions could be saved from the people? But you know what? What is interesting and beautiful about Imam Ali and his personality and his statements and his way of life and his manners and morals and ethics is that it's not limited to just one aspect. So we talked about religious scholars, we talked about a religious student or a student of religion, but this applies to probably every profession. For example, if you're a car mechanic, or if you're a doctor, or if you're a pharmacist, or if you're a teacher, if you're a university professor, or even if you're a mother or a father, and somebody asks you a question and you don't know the answer, instead of making something up and giving wrong information to your patient or to your student or to your children, it is safer for you and for the person that you are addressing to just merely say, I do not know, Allah knows better, and furthermore, if I search and find the answer, I will provide it to you. What a different kind of world, what a safer world, what a more prosperous world we would live in if we followed these kind of teachings and sayings by Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so yet, dear friends, another profound, simple, but beautiful, life-changing lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
His name brings about a sense of strength in the heart. His remembrance is a source of inspiration for the souls. His legacy is widespread throughout the centuries and around the world. When we examine this phenomenal character, this individual that today we are not able to appreciate all of its qualities. And you know, they call us people who exaggerate who Ali ibn Abi Talib was. One of the scholars says, I was told, you exaggerate, you speak too much fada'il of Ali. You are someone who is excessively in love with this man. I said to him, don't worry, I am still at the aim and I haven't yet gone further. He said, what do you mean? He said, don't think I'm still at the A of Ali. I am at the A of the alphabets of fada'il of Ali. No doubt you and I are not worried when people come and tell us, what is this association with Ali ibn Abi Talib that you have? Because we have understood his excellence. We have understood that through him is salvation. A man who was born in the best of places and martyred in the best of places and was martyred on the best of nights. A man who lived his life for the association of Allah and Tawheed. A man who gave everything for the religion of Allah. A man whose eloquence and bravery and wisdom and dedication is unmatched after the Holy Prophet. Why would we reduce as our association and our remembrance of this honorable individual? This association must continue and it must live on. Yet for us to strengthen that bond with Ali the Magnificent, Ali the man whose heart was full of love towards others, Ali who wanted his followers to follow in his footsteps in the best way. Those around Amir al-Mu'mineen recognize this. Salman al-Muhammadi al-Farisi, Radwanullahi ta'ala alayh, one day was walking behind Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen looks behind and he sees that Salman takes every step that Ali takes, exactly placing his feet. Look at that. And the way that those around Amir al-Mu'mineen recognized that this association is blessed. This association is the association of salvation.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
A Leak in Paradise. Part 2.
Playing golf is important for bankers. It's a good place to talk to clients because no one is going to listen to you on the golf course. The high net worth individuals, we wouldn't meet them in the office. I worked in 8 secrecy jurisdictions, Cayman Islands, BVIs, Bermuda, Guernsey, Jersey, Isle of Man, Mauritius, all of them had golf courses.